And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your ebulliently genial host, John Derbyshire, with some tidbits from the week's news. I owe an apology to those who prefer to read the Radio Derb transcript rather than to listen to the podcast. The rule is that I archive the transcript on my website late on the Wednesday following each Friday's podcast. This week, however, I was distracted and did not post the transcript until Friday morning. The hungry sheep looked up and were not fed. I offer my humble apologies. So much for last week. What's been happening this week? Let's take a look. Wednesday this week, we had another GOP presidential candidates debate, the third. I'm proud to report that I actually sat through this one and stayed awake to the end with the assistance of ardent spirits. The debate was in fact quite watchable. Good TV, as they say. It needed to be. Game 2 of the World Series was being played on another channel. It double needed to be, in fact, as the host channel, CNBC, advertised it as concentrating on, quote, the economy, social security, and numerous fiscal and global issues, end quote. Those are the kinds of things debates should be about, but stated like that, the thing looks dry and wonky. So, why was the debate good TV? In part because of the variety of personalities on the stage. 10, count them, 10 candidates, each with a different style and different things to say. We like a wide variety of personality in our human dramas. Someone to cheer for, someone to boo for. Ask any novelist or playwright. Ann Coulter thought 10 were too many. I disagree. We want a new president. We've got 200 million souls to choose from, discounting for minors, felons, and the foreign-born. Let's not winnow it down to just 2 or 3 a year before the election, as the Democrats have basically done. The other thing that made the event watchable was the interesting tension between the candidates and the moderators, who were, of course, all mainstream media lefties. The candidates had much sport with these moderators. "This is not a cage match," Ted Cruz told them. Marco Rubio declared that the Democratic Party has the ultimate super PAC, the mainstream media. "Is this a comic book version of a presidential campaign?" one moderator asked Donald Trump. Trump slapped him down, politely. The studio audience loved this, applauding when candidates took the offensive against the moderators, booing the moderators themselves several times. Who knew there were that many Republicans in Boulder? The only time I was there, it looked like Lefty Central. All Birkenstocks, bicycles and neckbeards. Anyway, the jousting between candidates and moderators was all good, clean fun. I'll confess that my sympathies for the candidates on this were very limited. "I want to see these guys," asked forceful and impertinent questions. Those are the kinds of questions they should be asked. They sometimes seemed to be saying, "Why don't you give us slow-pitch softball questions like you give Hillary and Bernie?" Well, I think that's the wrong thing to ask. I think the right thing to ask is, "Why don't you give Hillary and Bernie mean, snarky questions like you give us?" But we know the answer to that, don't we? All that aside, what did we learn about the candidates and their positions? Well, we learned that they all have a tax plan. "I rolled out my tax plan today," Ted Cruz told us. "My tax plan is a pro-family tax plan," said Marco Rubio. "My tax plan is unique," boasted Rand Paul. "All God's chillen got wings. All GOP presidential candidates got a tax plan." It was left to Carly Fiorina to throw some cold water on all this tax plannery. The lady had obviously listened with close attention to the tax fatalism segment in my October 2nd Radio Derb. "We've been talking about fixing the tax code for decades," she said, "but, quote, we never get it done. It never happens," end quote. "Yes," I was muttering to the TV at that point. "Yes, tax fatalism. Embrace it." It turned out, however, that Ms. Fiorina's sortie into Derbish pessimism was a mere rhetorical ploy. She has a tax plan too. She will reduce the current 73,000-page tax code to 3 pages. 3! One of the early socialist philosophers said that when a society of perfect justice and equality has been attained, the seas will lose their saltiness and turn into lemonade. So there are historical precedents for Ms. Fiorina's promise of a 3-page tax code. Chris Christie was on good form. He has a way of cutting through romantic rhetoric to the essentials. Speaking of Social Security, Mike Huckabee said, quote, "It's their money," that is, the American people's. "It's not government money. This is a matter not of math. This is a matter of morality," end quote. Christie, who favours raising the Social Security eligibility age and means-testing recipients, said, quote, "The only way we're going to be moral is to start by following the first rule we should all follow, which is to look at them, treat them like adults, and tell them the truth. It isn't there anymore, Mike. They stole it. It got stolen from them. It's not theirs anymore. The government stole it and spent it a long time ago." End quote. That's plain speaking. I like that. What about the national question, though, on which Christie is clueless? It turns out they're all just as clueless. The only halfway sensible thing said on immigration was said by Marco Rubio, who wants to limit chain migration in some way he didn't specify. Rubio, however, is known to favour massive increases in H-1B guest worker visas to replace American workers with cheaper foreigners. He's actually put forward a bill to do just that. And, contrary to some of the things he said on Wednesday, the bill has no protections for American workers and no safeguards against abuse. Rubio is an obedient and shameless shill for the cheap labour lobbies. Heck, he was one of the movers of the Gang of Eight amnesty bill 2 years ago. No one who gives a fig about American workers, American living standards, or American national cohesion should even think of supporting Rubio. H-1B visas have actually been in the news this week after a Florida TV station aired interviews with two IT workers at Disney who were replaced by cheaper H-1Bs from India and were forced to train their replacements on pain of losing their severance packages. This is deeply shocking to Americans who've heard of it, although it's not news to those of us on the national question beat. None of the candidates on Wednesday night had anything to say about it. What about Donald Trump, though? He's stolen the limelight in previous debates. How did he do in this one? That's going to need another segment. An ego the size of Trump's really needs a whole podcast, but I think I can hold it down to a segment. Trump broke hearts here on the patriotic right by repudiating his own immigration position paper, which we've been sighing and swooning over for the past few weeks. He did it clumsily too, with a barefaced lie. One of the moderators had asked him, quote, "Mr. Trump, you had talked a little bit about Marco Rubio. I think you called him Mark Zuckerberg's personal senator because he was in favour of the H-1B. End quote. Replied Trump, "I never said that. I never said that." Well, if you want to be Clintonian about it, that is, strictly speaking, true. Trump did not say it. He did, though, include it in that position paper on his campaign website, and it's still there. Quote, "Mark Zuckerberg's personal senator, Marco Rubio, has a bill to triple H-1Bs that would decimate women and minorities," end quote. Referring to the loathsome reptilian Zuckerberg, Trump also said this in Wednesday's debate, quote, "I was not at all critical of him. I was not at all. In fact, frankly, he's complaining about the fact that we're losing some of the most talented people. They go to Harvard, they go to Yale, they go to Princeton. They come from another country and they're immediately sent out. I am all in favour of keeping these talented people here so they can go to work in Silicon Valley." End quote. That adds ignorance to bad faith. Foreigners who graduate from Ivy League universities are not immediately sent out. Most of them go back voluntarily to their own countries, where a Harvard degree is highly prized. Any who want to stay and settle here have no difficulty doing so. There has been much speculation on National Question websites about what's happened to Trump here. Is he trying to get respectable with GOP elites by switching to the party line of illegal immigration bad, legal immigration wonderful? Or did he not read his own position statement? Or is he, as his detractors have been telling us, just a shallow airhead who will say one thing on a Tuesday and the opposite thing on Wednesday without noticing the contradiction? My own take is that there are two things going on here. One is that Trump, a very talented man in many ways, is just not good at thinking on his feet. I bet he suffers from staircase wit, driving home in the limo, tormented by thoughts of, "Damn, why didn't I say this?" Or, "Damn, why did I let them get away with that?" In this, Trump has my entire sympathies. I'm not much good at thinking on my feet either. That particular talent, though, while not a deal-breaker in a presidential election, not for me anyway, is a lot more important in the job Trump's aiming for than it is in my job. So his weakness here is a negative. The other thing that's going on is Trump schooling himself to be nice. For weeks, all the people around him have been telling him, "Be nice, be nice." He's trying to rein in his street fighter instincts. And at age 69, reining in the instincts of a lifetime is not easy. Trump is trying especially hard to be nice to his fellow candidates. I think what flashed into his mind when they hit him with the Zuckerberg thing was, They want me to turn on Rubio. They want me to be mean to the other candidates. He'd decided that he wasn't going to do that, so he sidestepped clumsily. Personally, I would have stood up and cheered if Trump had crossed the stage, taken out a box cutter, opened up Marco Rubio from the knave to the chaps, and played skippy rope with the little rat's entrails. I'm not the average voter, though, so that doesn't signify. There is a case, even from my point of view, there is a case for what Trump's trying to do. He's just not doing it very well. Post-debate, Trump walked back towards his original position paper in an interview with Breitbart.com. All right, but damage was done. What is the ratio of numbers here? People who watch a primetime televised debate versus the number of people who read Breitbart.com. 1,000 to 1 is probably close. Trump lost a lot of votes there. The votes of people who thought that at last, there was a credible candidate who believes that, to quote from Trump's immigration position paper again, quote, real immigration reform puts the needs of working people first, not wealthy, globe-trotting donors, end quote. As a footnote here, the other thing this incident shows is how incompetent these big news network moderators are. They're just not much good at their jobs. The moderator who hit Trump with the Zuckerberg quote should have had a printout of Trump's immigration position paper right there with the Zuckerberg section yellow lighted. She should have quoted it right back at him, chapter and verse. Instead, she melted away with, quote, so this was an erroneous article the whole way around? My apologies, I'm sorry. The lady is, says her profile on the CNBC website, quote, known for her hard-hitting interviews and profiles of some of the world's richest and most influential investors, end quote. Oh yeah? Hard-hitting? I say she's been missing her workouts with the punch bag. Perhaps I should make allowances here. That moderator is a hot, youngish blonde, while Trump is an alpha male with published testimonials to his sexual prowess. Possibly that moderator was disarmed by him. Possibly there was something other than fact-checking going through her mind. Or some other region. Who knows? Never ignore biology. From the minutiae of domestic policy bickering to the grand Metternichian generalities of global strategy. Tuesday this week, the USS Lassen, a guided missile destroyer, steamed by two little atolls in the South China Sea. These specks are part of what people are starting to call the Great Wall of Sand. A lot of them are only just barely above water. In fact, some of them are entirely below sea level at high tide. China's been selectively building them up, though, with huge power dredgers sucking up sand from the seabed and depositing it on the specks, making them real solid islands. Then China builds military installations on these new islands. Harbours, helicopter pads, airstrips, radar. The general rule in international law is that a nation's sovereign territory includes waters 12 nautical miles, which is 14 regular miles, out from its shores. Foreign seagoing vessels, including military vessels, have the right to enter those waters, though, provided that such passage is not, quote, prejudicial to the peace, good order, or security, end quote, of the sovereign nation. You can see that, as usual with international law, there's a lot of wiggle room there for the lawyers, and also for prickly nations that are out strutting around looking for a fight. Well, the aforementioned American destroyer, the Lassen, deliberately sailed within that 14-mile limit of these new islands. Why did they do that? First, to demonstrate that China can't unilaterally repeal international law. Second, to reassure nearby countries that we are still the big dog in the Western Pacific. China, you see, has been claiming these specs and building them up into military bases in order to assert her control over the entire South China Sea. Be clear, please, that China is not claiming the South China Sea as sovereign territory. That would be preposterous. She does, though, claim that islands and atolls in the sea are her territory, all the way out from China to a line that at some points is 1,200 miles from China's shores, right up against the beaches of Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. And there are so many of these specs, China might as well be claiming the whole sea. Those countries, which in some cases have counterclaims against the specs, those countries are naturally worried about this. We're worried about them being worried. Hence, the Lassen's little trip through what China claims as her territorial waters. Note that we're not denying that claim, although it's highly deniable. We're just asserting a long-standing principle about territorial waters. Could this turn nasty? Is China strutting around looking for a fight? My answers to those two questions: one, yes, it could turn nasty, but two, probably not yet. Deng Xiaoping's policy, which I believe the Chai Coms still adhere to, was to smile and play nicely while building up strength. Then, when you're strong enough, then let out your inner bully. Is China yet that strong? Or more to the point, do the Chai Com leaders think they are? Answers: no, and I doubt it. Guided missile destroyers? We have 66 of those suckers. China has less than 30, and some of those are just pretending. So I'm not losing sleep right now. 10 years on, I will be. Did I use the adjective Metternichian back there? I believe I did. Metternich, full name Clemens Wenzel Nepomuk Lothar Fürst von Metternich-Winneburg zu Beilstein. They don't make names like that anymore. Metternich was a 19th century Austrian diplomat who was instrumental in restoring order in Europe after the 25 chaotic years that followed the French Revolution. The order he restored was one of powerful nations in rough equilibrium, none seeking to dominate the others, none being allowed to trample too much on the small, weak nations among them. Balance of power is the catchphrase in school history books. It was a pretty good system. It kept the peace, mostly, for 100 years. Oh, there was the Crimean War and the Franco-Prussian War and some lesser eruptions, but nothing on the Napoleonic or Hitlerian scale. We should hope to live in a Metternichian world, with a handful of great powers mostly respecting each other and mostly not invading and looting the small fry. To get to that world, though, is going to need some mental adjustments on the part of America. Post-World War II, We were top dog. Europe was a wreck. Asia was dirt poor. The USSR was a military second-rater and a cultural and economic fifth-rater. That's not the case anymore and won't be again. We are strong enough to be the hegemon in our own sphere. That's the Americas and the Caribbean. But we need to seek equilibrium with other hegemons. With China in the Western Pacific, with Russia in North and Central Asia, with India in South Asia. We need some unified policies with them to damp down trouble among the small fry, the Middle East, Africa, Southeast Asia, North Korea. China wants hegemony in her sphere. We should cautiously yield it to them. That we still have tens of thousands of troops stationed in that sphere, in Japan and South Korea, is preposterous. I can't see any principled objection to Chinese hegemony. True, the Chinese Communist Party is a corrupt, unelected clique of gangsters. Some of the nations of Metternich's Europe weren't beauty pageant contestants either. But they got along with each other. That was the main thing. History's full of accidents and blunders. There are no guarantees. The Chai Coms could do something aggressively dumb tomorrow. Something that sends us all up in thermonuclear flames. It's not a risk-free world and never will be. We should strive for as much stability and security as we can get, though, and a Metternichian equilibrium between roughly equal powers is the best hope for that. My main point here is those mental adjustments we need to make. They don't come easy to us Americans, who had the 20th century pretty much to ourselves. We are not natural Metternichians. We're too moralistic and too romantic. Huddled masses, shining city on a hill, hope of the world. It's all meant well, and it's not ignoble, but it hinders us from thinking Metternichially. The greatest Metternichian thinker we've produced recently, Henry Kissinger, is widely disliked on both the right and the left. So I think mental adjustments are needed. In particular regard to China, we should let them know that we don't mind their hegemony in the Western Pacific, but we expect it to be conducted in a civilised, collegial fashion. We want them to be good Metternichians too. There are pressure points and sanctions that we can apply by way of persuasion. As Pat Buchanan often points out, our trade policies are a huge favour to China. We could make that less huge. Here's another suggestion from me. Thursday this week, I went to a function at New York University in downtown Manhattan. I can tell you that the modal language in the corridors and elevators of NYU and in the streets and subways feeding it is Mandarin. Published statistics on the NYU student body say 19% of full-time undergraduates are Asian, although with no separate breakdown on how many are US citizens. That was for 2013, the latest numbers I can find. I don't know. Mooching around the place, it looks and sounds to me like way more than that. Are we handing out too many student visas? Are there American kids missing out on higher education to all these foreigners? Maybe that's another pressure point we could use to nudge China towards Metternichian reasonableness. Just a thought. I'm a race realist. What does that mean? It means I don't doubt that race is a real and important thing. More than that, it's fundamental to biology. The foundational text of modern biology is Charles Darwin's book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Subtitle, The Preservation of Favoured Races in the Struggle for Life. By races, Darwin meant local varieties of a species. Any widely distributed species exhibits local varieties, races. If local varieties are left alone for long enough, breeding mainly within their local groups, they diverge. If left alone for way long enough, they diverge so far that members of local group A over here can no longer interbreed with members of local group B over there. The different races have then become different species. That's the origin of species. That's what Darwin's book is all about. How long is long enough? That depends on how intense is the pressure of selection driving the divergence. Animal breeders practicing artificial selection can get noticeable divergence in a few tens of generations. The Russian zoologist Dmitry Belyaev bred tame Siberian foxes from very wild ones in just 40 generations. He got significant tameness in just 5 generations. Natural selection doesn't work that fast, but if selection pressures are strong enough, tens of generations are enough for observable divergence. And it depends on what you mean by natural. Greg Cochrane and Henry Harpending have argued that the mean high IQ of Ashkenazi Jews developed across 1,000 years, say 40 generations, as a result of rigidly enforced social practices and norms. The major continental-scale human races have been more or less separated, often in very different environments with different selection pressures, for hundreds of generations. The really big split between the group that left Africa and the group that stayed there happened from 50 to 70,000 years ago. That's 2,000 or 3,000 generations. So expect lots of divergence between the human races. Darwin didn't know how heritability worked. He knew that some traits are heritable. Everybody knows that. But he didn't know the mechanism. Now we know it. The mechanism is genetics. We also know much more about what traits are heritable. Starting with the Minnesota twin study 35 years ago, and now with a mountain of data from twin, sibling and adoption studies, we know that pretty much anything you can quantify about human personality, behaviour and intelligence is to some degree heritable. Average at around the 50% level, but sometimes much higher. We now, in fact, have a busy and exciting field of study called behavioural genetics. Given that all these traits are heritable, it follows from the ordinary laws of biology that different races will exhibit different statistical profiles on them. That's not astonishing, mysterious, or horrible. It's just first floor level science. Unfortunately, it's also in contradiction with our state ideology. Forced to choose between science and ideology, most of the big institutions of our society have chosen ideology. An exceptionally clear example of this choosing was offered by the American Anthropological Association 5 years ago. At their annual meeting, the association voted to drop the word science from their mission statement. You can't get any more clarity than that. Academic anthropology in America is now a political movement in support of the state ideology. Well, I'm a race realist. I think science is the bee's knees, and the state ideology is nonsense. That makes me close to unemployable, but psychologically serene. To quote from that great movie Animal House, knowledge is good. Why am I telling you all this? Because I have a point to make about words, which I'm also rather fond of, and about current news reporting. I've gone on at a bit too much length with these prefatory remarks, so let me give the main point its own segment. So here's the thing. Given all that I just said, and supposing it was all correct, how do custodians of the state ideology explain the obvious issues that arise from race differences? For example, the huge and stubbornly persistent black-white gaps in criminality, educational attainment, and so on. The short answer is they fall back on magic. Magical thinking is hardwired into human cognition, and I doubt anyone is completely free of it. I am, as Radio Derb listeners know, the very soul of ice-cold rationality. Yet, every day when I walk my dog, I have to pat my lucky tree at the end of the street. Why? Because it feels right. If I don't pat the lucky tree, I feel uneasy for a few minutes. Why endure that unease? Magical thinking in official, academically sanctioned explanations for phenomena generally gets dropped when good, solid, scientific, replicable scientific results become available. This can take a while, though, as the history of science amply shows. When the phenomena to be explained are social phenomena, resistance is especially strong. You see this in our current official explanations for the social issues arising from race differences. Institutional racism, stereotype threat, white privilege. If you look closely at these concepts, you see that they are essentially magical, mysterious emanations or vapours, invisible and unquantifiable, known only by their results, like the messages sent from the spirit world to a Ouija board. In the past couple of decades, we've seen the rise of one particular explanatory strategy. That strategy recently acquired a name. Or possibly it's had the name for a while and I only just recently noticed. Whatever. I really like the name. The name of this explanatory strategy is Magic Dirt. The core idea is that one's physical surroundings, the bricks and mortar of the building that you're in, or the actual dirt you're standing on, emit invisible vapours that can change your personality, your behaviour and your intelligence. That's why, for example, you read so much about bad schools or failing schools. The thing to be explained here is that schools whose students are overwhelmingly non-Asian minorities, blacks and mestizos, these schools get much worse results on academic tests than schools whose students are majority white and East Asian. This has been so for decades, defying even extravagantly expensive efforts to change it, like the Kansas City fiasco of the 1990s. Parsimonious explanation? Innate differences in behaviour, intelligence and personality between the races. Magical explanation? Bad schools! The bricks and mortar of these schools, the asphalt of their playgrounds, are giving out invisible noxious vapours that enstupidate the kids. Bob Weisberg tossed and gored the whole bad schools flim-flam in his 2010 book, Bad Students, Not Bad Schools, which I recommend to your attention. Another aspect of the magic dirt theory is the current popularity of economist Raj Chetty's researches on social mobility. Analysing millions of individual tax returns from the 1990s, and then the returns of those individuals' now adult children 15 years later, Chetty found there's more social mobility in some places than in others. Who would have thunk it? Sample quote from him. For children growing up in places like Salt Lake City, the odds of moving from the bottom fifth of the national income distribution to the top fifth are more than 12%. In contrast, in cities like Charlotte, North Carolina, a child's odds of moving from the bottom fifth to the top fifth are less than 5%. End quote. Parsimonious explanation? Those places have different proportions of the various races. So, race differences in average behaviours cause different outcomes. Official explanation. Magic dirt. Salt Lake City's dirt has beneficial qualities that Charlotte's just doesn't. A very cynical person, not me, you understand, but a hypothetical extreme cynic, might surmise that Professor Chetty's research is funded by the real estate industry as part of their plan to reclaim America's cities for upscale whites by driving out minorities and scattering them to different towns and suburbs so they can improve themselves by living on better dirt. You see? Magic dirt theory is a key component of immigration romanticism too. Sure, Mexico and Central America are messed up places, and presumably their inhabitants played some role in messing them up. If we just move 30 or 40 million of those people to the USA, though, our magic dirt will transform them into civic-minded Jeffersonian yeomen. Our hypothetical extreme cynic might again wonder if there isn't some commercial interest at work behind the scenes there. Central Americans work for very low wages, especially when they're here illegally and dare not complain. Magic dirt, the explanatory power of it is truly wonderful. Perhaps we can use it to elucidate string theory or the mystery of consciousness. I wouldn't be surprised if the Higgs boson is implicated somehow. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Austria. Austria is punching above her weight in this week's podcast, with a whole segment there on Metternich, and now this. Headline from Russia Today. Austrians snapping up shotguns as thousands of Mideast refugees enter country. The substance of the story is that Austrians are trampling flat the Edelweiss in a stampede to arm themselves as young Muslim men pour into their country. You can buy a shotgun in Austria without a permit. For rifles and handguns, there is paperwork. Applications for that paperwork have soared. Shotguns are walking off the shelves of gun stores. Austrian women are especially keen to arm themselves, apparently having heard that the Quran sanctions the rape of infidels. There's plenty of room to conceal a SIG 9mm in a dirndl. As a gun-owning American, I can't repress a pleasant shiver of schadenfreude here. How many times have we heard Europeans lecturing down their noses at us about our coarse, crude, ungebildet gun culture? Now the hills are alive with the sounds of shooting practice. It's wonderful what a little dash of reality will do. Shotguns, pistols, rifles, ammo clips.
These are a few of my favourite things.
Item. Here's an upbeat item. A small reminder that we do, for all our grumbling, we do live in a country with a real belief in the equality of all before the law, and a real respect for each other as fellow citizens of a free republic. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey took the Amtrak express train from Washington, D.C. back to New Jersey last Sunday morning after appearing on Face the Nation. Now, you need to know that the express has a quiet car where passengers can read or doze without being disturbed by other passengers conversing or gibbering into their cell phones. Christie got into the quiet car. He wasn't quiet, though. When he got on the train, he was yelling at his state trooper detail for some mix-up in seating arrangements. Once he sat down, he started talking into his cell phone. Passengers complained. The conductor had a word with Christie, and Christie got up and left the quiet car. Whether or not with good grace, accounts differ. He left, though. That's the main thing. My wife put this into perspective for me. She grew up in communist China and is fully acquainted with the arrogance and entitlement of public officials in the Third World. She thought the Christie story was wonderful. She was chuckling about it for days. Imagine, she marvelled, the governor of a state, and he just got up and left. On orders from a train conductor. In China, unthinkable. So, count your blessings, Americans. We're not third world yet. Item. Just one more China-related item. The heading here, I think, is Microaggression of the Week. The microaggressor is veteran BBC TV sports commentator Mitch Fenner, covering the World Gymnastics Championships. At one point, the cameras went to some Chinese spectators waving a Chinese flag enthusiastically. Said Fenner, in what was interpreted as a mock Chinese accent,
"Oh wow, they say, look at that, we're from China."
The mountains heaved, the oceans boiled, and to prevent the earth from crashing into the sun, the BBC hastened to issue an apology. Fenner had acted inappropriately, they honked, and he had been reprimanded. Fenner himself did the full multiculti cringe. Quote from the Beeb. "The commentator has been advised that the tone of his commentary on this occasion might be considered offensive to some people, which he has acknowledged." End quote. My latest information is that Fenner is being shunned by his colleagues and made to feel ronery. So ronery. Item. Finally, yes, the Miss Bum Bum pageant, not to be confused with the Golden Globes. The invaluable Mail Online website, which describes the pageant somewhat ambiguously as tongue-in-cheek. The Mail Online reports that the 15 finalists have now been locked up together in the Miss Bum Bum mansion in Sao Paulo, where they are filming a reality show in preparation for the finals next month. Relations among the contestants are, the Mail Online reports, frosty. They may, in fact, have hit rock bottom. Quote, there is a distinct lack of small talk among the contestants at the Miss Bum Bum Mansion. End quote. Oh dear. My own favourite contestant, 27-year-old Sabrina Boing Boing, explains, quote from her, when we all met 4 months ago, on the first day we were all the best of friends, but by the second day that had all gone and the daggers started. Most of the women can't bear to even look at each other in the eyes, but when they have passed, they take a good look at their bum-bum to check out the competition. We might not have got to know each other, but everyone knows very well the other girls' bottoms. A lot of the women spend their time bitching about them on social media, saying, this one doesn't have a bum, that one is all cellulite. There is a lot of bottom in the house, but not much personality. End quote. A lot of bottom, but not much personality, eh? Kill surprise. Well, let's hope for some Metternichian equilibrium there among the ladies at the Miss Bum Bum Mansion. Once violence breaks out in a situation of close confinement like that, it's just a race to the bottom. Oh, come on. That's nothing like as bad as tongue-in-cheek. That's all for this week, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. There was somewhat of an Austrian theme in this week's show, and also somewhat of a Chinese theme. See how deftly I have woven the two themes together for our sign-off music. A very pleasant choral rendering of Edelweiss in Chinese. More from Radio Derb next week.